bright screens, late shifts, a silent plate, a shadow lands on my cell gate.
Welcome to Base by Base, the paper cast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Imagine for a second, a medieval castle under a massive, relentless siege. You've got the invaders outside, and they're just throwing everything they have at the walls, trying to breach the gates.
Right, and in this, like, microscopic scenario, the castle is a single bacterial cell, and the invaders are phages.
Which are viruses, right?
Exactly. They're viruses that specifically hunt, infect, and, well, kill bacteria. They're actually some of the most abundant biological entities on the planet, which means this the siege analogy you're making, it's happening billions of times a second all around you.
Yeah, it's just wild to think about. And usually when we talk about this, we think of bacteria defending themselves with, you know, genetic tools.
Yeah.
Like swords and shields made of proteins.
Yeah, like CRISPR or something.
Right. But some bacteria, they use a completely different, almost scorched earth strategy. They build a chemical moat. They basically deploy these small toxic molecules into the environment around them to just stop a viral invasion dead in its tracks.
It's a phenomenal form of chemical warfare, honestly. The bacteria secrete what are known as DNA intercalating molecules.
Intercalating. So what does that actually mean?
Well, instead of chopping up the virus, like a lot of genetic defenses do, these chemicals essentially wedge themselves into the genetic machinery of the invader. They basically jam the gears.
Okay, let's unpack this. If the bacteria just poison the virus, why do the bacteria end up dying too?
Yeah, that paradox is exactly what we're exploring today. Because you'd logically think, you know, the chemical moat would save the castle. But under certain conditions, the castle burns down with the invaders still trapped in the courtyard.
It's so counterintuitive.
Right.
So today we are doing a deep dive into the source material from a 2026 paper published in PNAS to figure out the actual molecular mechanisms behind that burning castle.
And we definitely want to take a moment to celebrate the incredible 2026 work of this research team. They're from Forschungszentrum Jülich, Heinrich Heine University Düsseldorf, and their collaborators as well.
Right, because their work has massively advanced our understanding of how these small DNA intercalating molecules act as this really crucial layer of antiviral immunity.
Yeah. I mean, for decades, when microbiologists talked about phage defense, the conversation was almost entirely dominated by genetic systems.
Right, like we were saying earlier, the protein swords and shields.
Exactly. You think of restriction enzymes that act like molecular scissors to sever viral DNA, or the famous CRISPR-Cas systems that actually keep a genetic memory of past infections.
But there's a whole other world of defense going on, right? Like in the soil beneath our feet.
Oh, absolutely. Bacteria, like these soil-dwelling streptomyces, literally sweat out these small bioactive molecules.
And one of these chemical weapons is daunorubicin, right? Which, if that name sounds familiar to you listening, it's because human medicine actually co-opted it years ago.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. We use daunorubicin as a chemotherapy drug to treat leukemia.
Wow. So bacteria are using the same stuff we use for chemo to fight off viruses.
Basically, yeah. It belongs to a class of drugs called anthracyclines. And to understand how it works, you kind of have to picture the structure of DNA, you know, that classic twisted ladder.
Right, the double helix.
Yeah. So an anthracycline is this flat, multi-ringed molecule. And what it does is it physically slides right between the base pairs of DNA or RNA. It intercalates.
Like sliding a coin between the pages of a closed book.
That's a perfect way to put it, yeah. So when the cellular machinery tries to unzip or read that DNA, it hits this wedge and physically crashes.
It just stalls out.
Completely stalls. It is highly toxic, and we've actually known for quite some time that it blocks phages just as well as it blocks cancer cells.
But the how was a total black box, right? Like, we knew the chemical stopped the virus, but how it shaped the ultimate fate of that infected bacterial cell was just a total mystery.
Yeah, and to understand the mystery, we really have to differentiate between a bacterial suicide pill and something, much darker.
Oh, man. Okay, what do you mean by darker?
Well, you're looking at the critical difference between classical abort of infection and mutual destruction.
Okay, let's define those for a second.
Sure. So classical abort of infection is an act of extreme bacterial altruism.
Like jumping on a grenade.
Precisely. The cell detects a virus, realizes the infection is beyond control, and just activates its own programmed cell death. It falls on its sword to stop the virus from replicating, and that saves the rest of the bacterial colony.
Okay, so what does this all mean? Are we saying the cell doesn't pull the trigger on itself, but rather the virus and the cell take each other down?
Exactly. Mutual destruction implies the cell never actually decides to commit suicide. The chemical defense mechanism stops the virus from completing its life cycle, yes.
Right.
But the stalled virus, which is trapped in this weird state of partial infection, manages to produce toxic byproducts. And those viral byproducts are what end up killing the host cell.
Oh, wow. So the outcome looks identical. You get a dead bacterial cell, but the underlying mechanism driving that death is fundamentally different.
Yeah, it's an entirely different chain of events.
So to figure out if this Donna-Rubison chemical defense was causing, you know, altruistic suicide or this darker mutual destruction, the researchers couldn't just look at one virus in a petri dish, could they?
No, not at all. They had to observe the interaction across a massive diverse population of viruses just to see the broader biological pattern.
And how do you even do that? Where do you get a massive population of viruses?
Well, they utilize the E. coli basal collection. This is a massive, meticulously curated library of taxonomically diverse phages.
Okay, that makes sense.
But to isolate the specific effect of the chemical defense, the researchers had to prepare a very specific controlled battlefield. They used a genetically stripped down E. coli strain called K12MG1655 Delta RM.
Wait, if this E. coli strain is completely stripped of its natural immune system, aren't we studying a totally artificial scenario in a vacuum? I mean, biology doesn't happen in a vacuum. If you strip a cell of its natural defenses, you're making it artificially weak. How does that tell us what actually happens in nature?
Yeah, that is a really critical piece of scientific skepticism, and it's a great question. But removing those systems is, well, it's a necessary compromise to establish a baseline.
So you have to simplify it first.
Exactly. If you want to understand exactly how the chemical Donna-Rubison is affecting the virus, you absolutely must remove any confounding genetic variables.
Ah, I see. Because if the native immune system was still active.
Right. If it were active, you wouldn't know if the cell survived because of the chemical drug in the environment or because of its own internal genetic scissors.
It's like you have to turn off the car's automatic emergency braking system to test if the physical brake pads actually work on their own.
That is exactly it. You isolate the variable.
Fair enough. Okay, so they take these vulnerable, stripped down E. coli cells and expose them to the phages, along with a very low concentration of Donna-Rubison.
Right, we are talking 10 micromolar. And that concentration is vital because it's low enough that it doesn't harm the uninfected bacteria.
So the chemical moat is there, but it isn't poisoning the castle's own water supply.
Beautifully said, yes.
So how did they actually monitor this microscopic siege?
They deployed an absolute arsenal of observational tools. They didn't just want to see who lived and died. They wanted to trace the entire timeline of the collapse.
Right, the play-by-play.
Exactly. They started with classic plate screenings to observe which viruses could successfully form plaques, which are those clear zones where bacteria have been wiped out.
Okay, the classic microbiology stuff.
Yeah, and they followed that with liquid infection assays to monitor the population growth of the bacteria in real time.
And then they took it a step further, right, with live cell imaging.
Oh, yeah. This is the cool part. They put these bacteria into microscopic microfluidic chips to just watch the battle unfold under a microscope.
That's incredible. And they added a special dye, didn't they? Propidium iodide.
Right. And what's special about this dye is that it cannot enter a healthy cell. It only slips inside and glows bright red when a cell's physical membrane is fundamentally compromised.
Meaning the cell is actively dying.
Exactly. But seeing a cell glow red tells you it is dying, but it doesn't tell you why.
Right. It doesn't give you the mechanism.
Right. So to understand the molecular narrative before the membrane collapsed, they used RNA sequencing.
RNA-seq.
Yeah. RNA-seq allows researchers to read the messenger RNA being actively produced in a given moment.
It's like intercepting the radio communications of the virus to see what commands it's issuing.
That's a great analogy. And they paired this with long read sequencing to track the physical presence and location of the viral DNA itself.
So having that microscopic surveillance state in place revealed some pretty shocking differences in how different viral families reacted to the chemical moat, didn't it?
It really did. Because it turns out, not all viruses care about Donna-Rubison. Taxonomy matters.
Wait, really? Some of them just ignore it?
Yeah. When screening the basal collection, these distinct evolutionary patterns emerged. Entire families of phages, such as the Drexlerviridae and Demerickviridae, were highly sensitive. The drug completely jammed their infection cycle.
Yeah.
But the Tevinviridae family, which includes the famous T4 phage, was a totally different story.
T4 was practically laughing at the chemical moat. It was completely resistant.
Yeah, and this presented an immediate biological mystery. Because we know the architecture of T4 is unique, it has an incredibly large genome, and more importantly, it hypermodifies its DNA.
Oh, right. It decorates its genetic code with complex sugars. Hydroxymethylglycosylation.
Nailed it, yes.
Like, it is wearing molecular armor. So the obvious assumption is that the chemical daunorubicin just cannot wedge itself into that densely armored DNA. It just bounces right off.
Right. That assumption makes complete logical sense. And it's exactly what the researchers initially hypothesized.
So how did they test that?
They went into the lab and engineered a mutant version of the T4 virus. They knocked out the enzymes responsible for building that sugar armor, leaving the virus with naked, unmodified DNA.
Oh, wow. Let me guess. Without the armor, the drug tore the mutant virus to shreds and stopped the infection.
That is the crazy part, it didn't.
Wait, what?
Yeah, even completely naked, the mutant T4 virus remained entirely immune to the daunorubicin.
So the armor had absolutely nothing to do with it. The resistance to the chemical moat comes from some other mechanism entirely.
Exactly. Perhaps how T4 injects its DNA or how it packages it.
That is a fascinating unknown for future study. But to understand how the mutual destruction actually works, the researchers had to kind of pivot away from the resistant T4, right?
Yeah, they had to look closely at the phages that were sensitive to the drug. They focused heavily on a Tukinta virus called BOS-33.
What happens to BOS-33 is wild. It's like watching a bank robbery go wrong in slow motion.
It really is. So BOS-33 utilizes an infection mechanism called a first step transfer, or FST.
Meaning when it lands on the bacterial surface, it doesn't just dump its entire genetic payload into the host all at once.
Right. It acts like a highly calculated syringe. It docks onto the bacterium and injects only the first 9% of its genome.
Just 9%.
And this initial segment contains what virologists call pre-early genes, specifically genes named A1 and A2.
And what do those do?
Their biological purpose is to serve as an advanced demolition and preparation crew.
Okay, so under normal drug-free conditions, that first 9% goes in, hijacks the cellular machinery, and then signals the virus parts on the surface to inject the remaining 91% of the DNA.
Exactly. But when daunorubicin is present in the environment, it blocks the infection right after that first step. Yeah, the rest of the virus's genome is permanently stuck outside the cell.
Wow. And the RNA sequencing data illuminated the consequences of this blockage perfectly, didn't it?
It did. Because the remaining 91% of the DNA never enters the cell, the virus cannot replicate. There are simply no blueprints to build new viral particles.
Right.
However, those pre-early genes that did make it inside during the first step, they don't just sit dormant.
Oh.
They are actively transcribed by the host's own machinery. They continuously express over and over again.
And what exactly are those A1 and A2 pre-early genes doing while they express on this infinite loop?
Well, they act as molecular wrecking balls. One of their primary functions during a normal infection is to literally degrade the host bacterium's central chromosome.
Wait, really? They chop up the host's DNA?
Yes, they harvest the raw nucleotides, which the virus intends to use to build its own progeny.
So the virus is totally stuck at the door. It can't replicate. But the 9% advanced crew that got inside is just shredding the host's DNA endlessly because the signal to stop and start building never arrives.
Precisely. The virus is starved of its full genome, and the host is being pulped from the inside out.
That is brutal.
It is. The researchers tracked the colony-forming units, which is the number of living bacteria capable of reproducing, and they observed a massive 93% drop. The bacterial population was just collapsing.
But importantly, they weren't dying from a programmed suicide.
No, not at all. They died solely because of the toxic viral products accumulating inside them. The daunorubicin stopped the virus from reproducing, completely protecting the wider bacterial colony from a viral outbreak.
Right.
But it trapped that specific infected cell in a lethal, unending phase of DNA degradation. The virus failed and the host died anyway. That is the essence of mutual destruction.
It is beautifully tragic at the microscopic level, but the story doesn't end with a pile of dead cells.
Right. No, it doesn't. The researchers didn't just stop at that stripped-down, vulnerable E. coli. They asked the ultimate contextual question.
What happens if we give the bacteria some of their genetic weapons back?
Exactly. They reintroduced specific canonical immune systems back into the bacteria. They focused on restriction modification systems, specifically ones known as ECOV and ECOP1I.
Okay. And these are the genetic scissors we mentioned earlier, right?
Yes, exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting. It's like the drug traps the virus in the doorway, but the virus drops a toxic grenade. However, if the cell has a genetic security guard to defuse that grenade, the whole cell lives.
That is exactly what happens. The donor rubicin acts as the bottleneck, stalling the virus and preventing it from overwhelming the cell with its full genome.
Right.
But when the EcoP1i restriction system is present, it acts as that security guard. Restriction enzymes work by scanning DNA for specific sequence motifs. And it turns out there are 8 specific recognition sites for this enzyme right in that trapped 9% of pre-early viral DNA.
No way. So the restriction enzymes identify the toxic advance crew and chop up that pre-early viral DNA before it can degrade the host's genome.
Yes. Instead of the host's chromosome being shredded, the viral DNA is shredded. The toxic loop is broken.
So instead of mutual destruction, you get total victory for the bacteria.
Complete victory. The cells actually survive, clear the partial infection, and continue to grow. The chemical defense in the moat and the genetic defense inside the castle synergize.
They work together to do something neither could effectively do alone.
Exactly. And observing how these small DNA intercalating molecules perform differently in isolation versus when paired with genetic defenses, it completely shifts the paradigm of bacterial immunity.
If context changes the outcome this drastically from a 93% death rate to full survival, does this raise the question that we might have been misclassifying other bacterial immune systems for years just because we studied them in isolated stripped-down vacuums?
It absolutely forces that reevaluation. I mean, this paper fundamentally argues that modern microbiology must disentangle a defenses mechanism like how it physically works from its phenotype, which is the ultimate outcome of the cell.
Because if you only looked at the weak, stripped-down strain in a petri dish, you'd record the outcome as cell death.
Right.
You might mislabel it as classical abortive infection and just move on. You'd completely miss the fact that the drug is actually a synergistic stalling tactic waiting for genetic backup.
Exactly. When you test the exact same chemical mechanism in a fully equipped strain, the phenotype radically changes from cell death to full population survival. It's a vital reminder that biological systems are layered, complex networks. Evolution rarely relies on a single point of failure.
It is a stunning bit of molecular detective work. But, as with all great science, resolving one mystery reveals another. We know the donor rubicin traps the virus after that first 9% injection. We know it creates a bottleneck. But we still don't know the exact physical mechanism blocking that second step transfer of the remaining 91%.
No, we don't. That remains a prominent limitation of the current study and, honestly, a major target for future research.
Right.
We know the drug intercalates, but we don't know if it's physically wedging itself into the viral DNA so tightly that the DNA physically cannot slide through the narrow injection tube into the cell. Or, alternatively, the drug might be chemically inhibiting the specific viral proteins, like those produced by A1 and A2, that are actually meant to trigger the release mechanism for the rest of the DNA.
It's like we know the castle door is jammed halfway open, but we can't see if there is a physical chair wedged under the handle or if the structural hinges are just glued shut.
That's a great way to picture it. And discovering the exact molecular interaction at that second step transfer checkpoint is going to require advanced structural biology techniques.
Like what?
It's likely involving cryo-electron microscopy, just to see the blockage at an atomic resolution.
Okay, let's bring all these high-level genomic concepts back down to Earth for a moment. If there is one thing you take away from our deep dive into the source material today, let it be this.
Yeah.
Small DNA intercalating molecules act as a potent chemical defense, trapping invading phages in a partial infection state that results in the mutual destruction of both cell and virus. However, when layered with traditional genetic immune systems, this toxic stalemate transforms into a synergistic defense that ensures the host's survival.
It perfectly illustrates evolutionary layering. A single defensive chemical might be a blunt instrument that results in collateral damage, but combining it with targeted genetic systems creates an incredibly sophisticated, highly survivable immune response.
Which leaves us with a truly massive thought to chew on. What does this mean for our own clinical medicine? Could we mirror these exact bacterial synergies to design completely new combination therapies against drug-resistant superbugs?
It is a critical line of inquiry.
Because if bacteria combine broad-spectrum chemicals and highly targeted genetics to trap and destroy their enemies, why couldn't we do the exact same thing to them?
Exactly. If we can fully map the chemical moats and genetic guards of our microscopic enemies, we might finally learn how to breach their defenses and bypass antibiotic resistance for good.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Bright screens, late shifts, a silent plate, a shadow lands on my cell gate. I feel the first cold cross the line, then everything jams in the spine. Ink in the helix drawn too tight. It slips between the letters, locks the page. Turns the next step into a cage. Only the first lines get to breathe. The pre-early whisper under teeth, and I can't run. But I won't leave. Mutual destruction, that's the deal. If you take my life, you lose your will. No copies made, no future spun. Your pre-early sparks burn out the sun. I fall to stop the fades from having won. Some invader shrug, some breaking star. Tax a roulette in the lab hall. A heat map says who bleeds, who bends. But this one hits where sequence ends. A poison pen that shifts the odds. Layer on layer, defense is talk. Restriction cuts when doors unlock. Together we turn the tide to stay. Not every cell will see that day. But populations learn to live that way. Mutual destruction, here it rings. Official circuit closing in. First step taken, but the story's done. No